Okay, welcome to the third episode of this mini flipping best podcast season yet. Oh, I nailed that.
There's more to come.
There's more to
come. Second take because we couldn't get the name right.
So. Yeah, but like which name is that? There's a lot of names. And then there's sponsors and it goes on and on. I mean, this whole thing is just...
So you are listening to The Right Side Up with Danielle Strickland.
And James Scholl. James Scholl.
Formerly
known.
The Boundless Podcast.
But
not to be confused with
any collaboration with Focus on the Family.
Formerly the Danielle Strickland Podcast.
Yes.
That was too Danielle centering. We weren't into that.
Yes. So here we are.
My legions of fans were like, it's not right, James. It is not right.
Look, I'll talk to your mom later. And by the way, thanks, Mom, for the chocolate.
Yo.
Keep it coming. We call that living chocolate in my household. That marvelous creation, that's UK the... wonder, with like popping candy in it. That's... Like it makes all other chocolate feel dead.
Oh yeah, it's a right? problem, man. North American chocolate is bad.
Just dead.
No.
With like, and then you can have this living chocolate when that's alive in your mouth. I mean,
I have chocolate you do not know about.
Right. Anyway. This is the third episode, and we've been walking through the flipping the tables, cleansing the temple, gospel accounts. And of course, this is connecting to flipping the script of cynicism and despair and rediscovering our humanity in this sponsored season of The Other Side of Hope.
Sponsored by The Other Side of Hope, Danielle's upcoming book, although I guess... when this comes out, it'll be almost around the corner. So not long to wait now, folks.
Yeah, August 5th. You can pre-order. If you pre-order, you get a whole bunch of stuff. So you can sign up at my website, daniellestrickland.com/othersideofhope, to get some things that aren't in the book that you can get as a bonus, just because we like you.
At least your website's still fairly clear. The Right Side of Hope /boundless/Danielle.
Thanks for bringing that up, James. Now that's next on the list.
The Boundless website with Danielle Strickland. Right.
Not to be confused with or inferring any collaboration with any other ministry. Oh, gosh. Yeah, we're just going to stick with my name for that one just because it's Googleable.
Yeah.
Googleable. Okay, we're going to start Matthew chapter 21, verse 12. Jesus entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the temples of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you are making it a den of robbers. The blind and lame came to him at the temple, and he healed them. But when the chief priests and the teachers of the law saw the wonderful things he did and the children shouting in the temple area, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were indignant. So much hope there. They were excited about the growth of the church.
They like us.
No, they were indignant. Do you hear what these children are saying? They asked him. Yes, replied Jesus. Have you never read? From the lips of children and infants, you have ordained praise. And he left them and went out of the city to Bethany, where he spent the night. So there you have it. That's Matthew's version. We've talked about John putting this at the beginning of the gospel to say this is a different kind of leader. And we will not be following the script of worldly power.
On violence. Yeah.
Yep. On violence and power. And then we talked through... what was the second gospel that we read?
We just did Mark.
Mark. That's it.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. Mark.
Mark, lots of actions there. And we looked at Jesus turning over the tables of the money changers and the dove sellers. And we spoke about how.
The Tyrian shekel.
The Tyrian shekel. That's right.
Exploitative practices of the poor.
And how Jesus isn't okay with us putting up barriers to entry to worship, and especially barriers that particularly exploit the most marginalized and most vulnerable of people.
Oh, and disrupting the status quo to usher in genuine peace.
Yes.
Yes, that's always important.
It seems the kind of thing Jesus would do.
Well, it's that also in my tradition, Catherine Booth has this great quote, there's no changing the future without disrupting the present. Mm. And that's what we want. We always want the change without any disruption.
Yeah.
But that's not happening.
And sometimes that means disrupting ourselves as well, mm-hmm. which is hard.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things I've been struck by in Matthew's gospel, I love this account for a bunch of reasons. One, it follows the triumphal entry again. So there's this like entrance as a different kind of leader. And then, of course, we talked about the Maccabean revolt and everybody expecting this kind of like overthrow of Rome. And in that revolt specifically, the Maccabeans went in and like took back the temple from an evil influence from outside of it that had taken over it. And in this account, Jesus goes straight to the temple as well. But instead of kicking out foreigners that are invading the temple, he's actually overthrowing existing religious practices that are corrupt and exploitative. So the threat is now not outside of them, it's inside of them, mm-hmm. which again, back to you, sometimes when we have these conversations, it's easy to go like, yes, those people over there and forget that all of us need to be disrupted.
Yep.
And we are the temple together, collectively, we are the temple of the living God. This God dwells in us and there needs to be a constant source of light and space and air and oxygen and cleansing and renewal, like spring clean me. And the hassle of it and the dust of it. And like, I don't even, this is one of the longest I've lived in a house without moving. So it's been 5 years now for me in Toronto.
Yeah.
And you know, you forget about the collective reality of living in one space, like without cleaning it properly, right? Like all the things, like the dryers, like the vents, like the blinds, the windows, the like, I mean, I'm just like, whatever. Cause what happens is I move in 3 years and I do all the cleansing every 3 years when I move the place. But when you are habitually in a place, those things still need to happen.
Yeah.
And I just forget about it. And now like all my things are breaking and it's getting to the end of, you know, like all, everything needs to be cleaned and like, and I was just like, what? This is so much work.
Let's just move.
Let's just move. And then this happens, right? Somebody else does this or something. Let's just move. It's easier. And I guess that's this season we're at, even as a church, it feels like as a collective people of God, that it's spring cleaning time. God's coming to us to help us cleanse what needs to be cleansed. One of the things that's always occurred to me is like, or I've asked myself, like, what is it about the people who have that capacity or calling like Jesus to come and disrupt things and to expose things and to flip things over? Mm. Like, what is it that compels them? How are they so attached? Like, obviously, this isn't a new system of sacrifice. It's not like people don't know this. Yeah. It's not like people aren't part of this. And so what is it about Jesus that compels him to do this? Mm. What motivates him? Like, why does he get so agitated that it's happening? Like, what is it that pulls on those strings? And consistently, it seems to me in scripture, Jesus is moved by compassion. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he does consistently, which I think for me is one of the things I'm trying to do in my life, is he is in proximity with those who are on the other side of economic power, or on the other side of religious power, or on the other side of, you know, social acceptance, or on whatever the other side is, he seems to be consistently positioning himself there.
Hmm. And I will say, and I plug for The Other Side of Hope, the book that is sponsoring this, in the story side in particular, in the theory too, but in the story side a lot, we get to see that actually. I think we get to see your authenticity in your discipleship and even your desire, right? To be in those spaces that Jesus wants us to be, and also the beautiful things that come out of that. I think this is one of the things that comes out over and over again, actually, is how much you celebrate those folks. It's not, I was in this place and I made their life so much better. It's, I was in those places and oh man, did it make things better? Did it change me for the better? I'm always a bit worried. I'm like, I don't so much as a teacher, but the kids teach me. And I'm like, well, be a better teacher then. I don't know. Like, you should like literally just be better at it. Right.
Cause it can just sound like virtue signaling.
Yeah.
But unless it's genuinely true.
Yeah.
But I also see that in Jesus' life where he's like, I haven't seen faith like this in all of Israel.
Yeah.
He says to a Canaanite woman, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
like, you know, puts her up on this. And like this other woman who reaches out and touches his guard. God, in your faith has made you well. And like he's also, I think, surprised by these centurion guard who's like, just say the word in my, and he's like, what? Like and I think it's that like God at work in those places and people who genuinely are encountering God rather than just going through motions. And, you know, so I think it's kind of a cool, maybe it surprised him too. I don't know, but certainly he pointed it out a lot. is like, look at where God and faith and hope and love is at work here, outside of the systems that we thought it would be or where we would think we would expect it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the other side of hope, is also recognizing that hope is wild. It's wild. It's not tame. And so I think we always want hope to be tame, like an on display. And hope refuses to perform. It's wild. And it shows up when it wants to. And like in the most unlikely of ways. And one of my favorite stories in the book is of this hunter friend of mine. And where he...
He's not so much a hunter. I think you specify that.
He goes hunting.
Yeah.
And he plays the whole part. He calls himself a redneck the whole bit. And he goes hunting and then he comes back with nothing. And I always, like, after a couple of years of knowing him, I'm like, are you just a really bad hunter? Like, why do you not come back for anything? And he talked about when he was a kid, his dad took him to kind of like man up and teach him how to hunt. And he saw this, they found this like mother deer and a fawn. And he was just so captured by the beautiful nature of them. And his dad's like, okay, now, you know, pull the trigger. And he's like, I just couldn't do it. So my dad did it. And he hit the mother deer. And he said he just like started bawling, like just bawling his head off at like the destruction of the beauty. And his dad just was like, man up, like gave him a hard time. And just like did the whole like shamed him for crying and all that kind of that hyper masculinity toxicity life.
Which and, is working out really well in the world, by the way.
Right. Right. And then he said, like, he actually really wanted to capture it again. Like, he wanted to behold, like he said, beholding an animal like that in the wild is like its own crazy thing. And so he goes hunting every year, even with his son, and they just go to find the deer and then they just behold them. And they don't shoot them. He just watches them. He's like, I can't pull the trigger, but I really love being part of it. And I think about that image of like hunting for hope. Yeah. And also when he told me that, I thought a lot about like how we want to shoot hope and put it on our wall. We want it to be static. Like, remember that time there was hope and we have it like on our wall now to show that we captured hope, but hope can't be captured.
Yeah.
Because it's living, it's alive, and it's wild. But we could maybe, if we're looking and still enough and willing enough, we could behold it. And that could be worth it.
Yeah.
It could be worth it. I feel like Jesus is like that, right? Wild hope. We behold him.
Yeah.
We can't capture
take it
him.
In, right? Just take it in. It's okay.
The temple doesn't own him.
Yeah.
The poor don't own him. The rich don't own him. The Romans don't own him. He's wild. God owns him.
And this is what happens when you get a kind of wild hope in a space like this, in a space where God is supposed to be object and subject of worship, and it's become about something else. It's become about exploitation, or it's become about keeping people out rather than letting them in. And man, Christians love to do that, don't we? We love to exclude. That's kind of our thing.
And this is where Jesus is with the excluded.
Yeah.
So this is one of the things. It's not as clear in this as it is in, I think, the final one we're going to talk about, but there's an outer court. And we already talked about the doves. That's where the poor are, or even people who couldn't, like women couldn't enter into the main sanctuary, children not allowed in, those with disabilities, those who were considered unclean.
Yeah.
And we know, you know, there's a bunch of, so people who had diseases, like all that stuff, they're all in excluded into the outer courts, which is where they're trying to get in. They can't even get into the outer courts. Yeah. So even the place that's been designated for them, which is still exclusive, even that's been made more exclusive by these like corrupt practices that we talked about last week. And so one of the things I realized when I was reading through this and studying through this is the reason Jesus feels so strongly about this is because this is who he's with.
Yeah.
And I had this like crazy image of like all these like really cool young hip rabbis who enter in like the left side door where it's like for the holy, and they enter into this like temple and they're having this conversation about reform and like why the temple's empty and like where are the people and like why don't we do things to change this? And like meanwhile, Jesus is with the excluded going, I have some ideas, you know. I remember this when all the Sunday school stats were just like going through the like just were like declaring declining like crazy. And I was like, I remember discovering like 100,000 foster care kids, you know, over 100,000 kids in foster care. And I'm like, how would this affect the stats?
Yeah.
Like, so we're all having these conferences after conferences after conferences, scratching our heads going like, what about the next generation? What about the next, we're losing all the kids. And I'm like, meanwhile, there's hundreds of thousands of kids without anyone who want them or welcomes them or makes a way for them to come, you know, so you're just like, maybe these things go together. And so in my mind, I'm sort of having this, like this desire of the Sadducees and the Pharisees and like these people. I don't think it's a bad desire. Jesus is not against them. I think he just has some ideas. Mikey's got some ideas. Like, I have an idea. Maybe revival comes. Like, maybe that renewal that you're longing for, maybe that like impulse and that desire for people to worship God again, maybe that comes, wait for it, by including the excluded.
From the exact people that Jesus said this is from. I get into trouble with lots of people all the time. That's okay. And they were, there was a big argument about theology, and they said something along the lines of, this is not the, I was talking about welcoming people because welcoming people is important to me. And they said, this is not the welcome. This is not the gospel that we have received. And I just like, but Luke 4 says, this is the gospel. This is what good news. Jesus says this is what the good news is. It's good news to the poor, and it's sight to the blind, and it's setting the captives free. Like, that's, we all receive that gospel. But you, so what one of you received? I don't understand. Like, right. I'm just confused.
Which one have you received? Because like, that's the one I'm preaching.
I'm just trying, and I get it wrong. Like, don't hear, if you're listening to this, like, I know James, he actually is terrible. I'm like, yeah, I know I am, but like, at least that's in my head. Like, that's the gospel I'm trying to receive. Like, that's the gospel I'm trying to work on. And so we see all these threads throughout Jesus's ministry, and we're like, oh, that does seem like good news to the poor. That does seem like setting the captives free. It's almost like he exactly told us he was going to do this.
Yeah, and it's where he is that matters.
Yeah.
So like, I was remembering in my history that we had this guy that came to our small group in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and he was a truck driver for a Salvation Army food bank. Mm. And he got really sick and he couldn't go get his check, but they couldn't send him his check. Someone had to go pick it up. So I was like, fine, I'll go pick it up. But we didn't have a car, so I had to take a bus over to this whole other section of Vancouver with a toddler in a stroller. It was like a nightmare, and he ran out of milk, and he was unhappy, and it was a long, terrible trip on the transit. And then I get to this Salvation Army place, and there's this like building, and then it's a really nice looking building, and I go up to the thing, and there's a big sign on the front saying, if you're here for the food bank, there's an arrow. You know, so I'm like, oh, okay. So I go behind, right? So then I follow behind, and then on the sidewall, there's another arrow. So then I'm like, oh, I keep going behind until I'm totally behind by the dumpster where there's this like entrance, and it's down these set of cement stairs behind the dumpster of this nice looking Salvation Army building to get to the food bank entrance. So I carry my stroller with my screaming kid after taking the transit down this cement staircase behind the dumpster of this building. And I, as soon as I get in the door, there's a plexiglass with a sign that says like, don't bother us, basically, like staff only. Yeah. And so by the time I get there, James, I'm so mad. I'm just, if I had had a sledgehammer, I would have gotten rid of that plexiglass. Like, I was so mad. And like, I waited there with the screaming kid. And then finally somebody notices I'm there and comes over and is like, can I help you? And I'm like, yeah, I'm here to pick up a check for, you know, so-and-so. And they're like, yeah, we don't know about that. And I'm like, well, maybe you could check with somebody. Now I'm an officer at this point. I'm not in uniform. I'm there with a screaming kid, right? And I'm so ticked off at this point. Like, I just hate all these people. Like, inside of me, I'm just like, you guys are all the worst. And then the officer happens to walk by and sees me, recognizes me, and comes over and is like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Takes me in this special room and gives me milk for my kid. And like, but it's too late. Yeah, it's done. Yeah, I don't care what you give me now. But also, not just, this isn't about me now.
You've already shown me.
Okay,
how
so
this is good news.
This is how this works.
And it ain't.
Yeah. Right. And what is it? It's like, what is this? What is the message of this? Yeah. So you're doing something really beautiful. You're doing something good. I'm all for food banks. I don't want them to end.
Yeah, great.
But what are the messages that are being received by people on this end? Right. And just that, like the lack of ability to put yourself in the place of the people who are coming, who you're trying to serve. I mean, this lack of empathy, this lack of, you know, sort of proximity to the very people you're trying to help. So I want you to stay with this thought for a second, because I want to finish it. So like a couple months later, I'm a guest speaker at an officer retreat. And the officers that are in charge of that whole ministry, so not the one that saw me that day and helped me, but the ones that are in charge of this whole ministry, asked for prayer. I said, okay, so what can I pray for you for? And they said, we just have such a heart to see the people that come to our food bank come to our church. And for the life of us, we cannot figure out why it's not happening. And I'm like, you know what? I think I might be the answer to your prayer.
I have an answer to your prayer. Yeah.
I think I know. I think I know the mystery. And ever since then, I've actually challenged everybody who does do beautiful work to actually go ahead and be the receiver of the work first. Walk through the process. Feel how it feels. Like, I actually wonder if those rabbis who were looking for like all the changes in the temple to make it more like God, if they had have been more like Jesus as a leader who was with the people that the gospel's for, like he was with them, which is why he felt, I'm convinced his like compassionate overflow that like, I cannot stop myself from removing the obstacles that are in the way for the people that I love and am with to encounter God and feel forgiven and know they belong and like encounter the living God. Like I cannot stop from doing this because he's compelled by compassion because of his proximity in the outer courts. And I don't know, maybe hang out in the outer courts more.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's part of the, and maybe that's where that hope comes from too, that drive of like, I'm going to change all this to be hopeful, because this is meant to be a center of hope that is actually just breeding more hopelessness, you know?
This is meant to be a house of prayer for all nations, and you have not made it that. I love that point, Danielle. I think that I realize I'm going back to Luke 4 and the good news, which is where I spend most of my life, admittedly, reading at least. But once you get to know folks, it stops being theoretical. It stops being this even sanitized thing, I suppose. But when Jesus is preaching, I've come to bring good news for the poor, he probably had some people in mind, you know, like, oh, they're my friends.
Like his family.
The poor, my friends in my immediate context, which is massively oppressed by the empire. Like, I've come to bring sight to the blind. Like, his name's Bartimaeus. You're going to meet him later.
Yeah.
I've come to bring, to set the captives free. And oh man, am I doing that? And this is kind of something that's helpful for me as well. Again, Jesus is good enough to kind of hold my hand really gently as I stumble towards what makes sense, I suppose. But again, that's the same thing, like good news for the poor. And I get to think of the people who I'm privileged to spend time with that fit that description. And again, my friends are in prison, and there's quite a few of them. Yeah. Again, like setting those captives free. I'm not asking for this theoretical captive. Like, it's my friend. Oh, so Stephen, there we go. That's a made up name. Like, but I can think of him now, and like how much better and beautiful it would be if Stephen was set free.
Yeah.
How that, again, but proximity changes things.
Yes, it does. It changes things. And even your, like recently I spoke at a conference, and it was the Foursquare conference, and it was just after Hagar's voice had been released, and the first woman that told her story was a woman from the Foursquare movement. And so it caused a lot of, as you might imagine, disruption, holy disruption in their national gathering to talk about this thing that wasn't talked about and wasn't known. And so there was a lot of, and thankfully they were open to receiving a word from the Lord still from me. So like, yay, thank you. You didn't crucify me. You could have. But even as I was there, I was really talking just about power and how we wield it and what it is and what God's power for and all that kind of stuff. Like just, I think what God's saying to the church right now, that's just this disruption of business as usual and centering the voices of others and laying down our lives, whatever it might cost for us to stop the corruption and stop the exploitation, like whatever that is, whatever that might cost, it might cost everything, worth it if it's God's kingdom coming. So just that thing. And one of the things I really felt led to do was just repent myself for the way that I've used power in the past, the way that I've used power to you know, amplify my voice over somebody else's, or the way that I've used power to say, like, you should work for me for free and it should kill you. And that's a godly thing to do, you know, like, cause it's,
I was fed a sandwich, by the way, guys, he's not talking to me right now.
And on it goes, right? But just this idea, this exploitative, destructive power, but we just dress it up as religious and then it's fine. Yeah. And so I just was repenting. But as I was repenting on the stage, I was like losing. It's so unlike me. Number one, I wore pink. Never happens. Number two, I cried. Never happened. Like, very rarely does that. I'm not a crier. Like, yeah. It's just not my natural bent. It takes a lot to get make me cry. So if you make me cry, man.
You really done it.
But I was repenting. As I was repenting, I had a godly sorrow. And the reason I had a godly sorrow, I think, is because I had someone in mind. When I was repenting for the way that I used power, I was actually thinking about all the Hagars, specifically by name. And I was thinking of them. And as I thought about them and the way they've been used and abused and then re-harmed and re-harassed and re-burdened and re-victimized, I had genuine sorrow. I mean, I am moved. So this proximity thing, I think it's a thing. Yeah. I think it's a genuine thing. And then I think not only does it motivate Jesus to disrupt the existing status quo, but the result, the instant result, that's one of the things I love about this passage, the instant result of the disruption is that the money-changing, corrupt guys are driven out and the blind and the lame and the children come running in.
Yeah.
That's like got to be the best. And that's where, like, back to that, like, those Renaissance paintings of like whips and like, yeah. Obviously Jesus was not whipping humans or children, and blind and lame people would not be running towards him celebrating and shouting about the blessing prophetically, you know, and the religious people going like, make it stop. When really it's like a celebration of what God's temple was for. Two passages of scripture that keep coming up in each of these accounts are from Jeremiah chapter 7 and Isaiah chapter 56. This is the den of robbers and the house of prayer for all nations. And I think it's just worthy of mentioning a couple things that happen in these chapters. So Isaiah 56 is like subtitled Salvation for Others.
I'm here for it.
Shocker.
That seemed like the kind of thing God would do.
Yeah. And he's saying literally, like, he names foreigners and he names eunuchs. So let no foreigner who has bound himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely exclude me from his people. And let not any eunuch complain, I am only a dry tree. For this is what the Lord says, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose what pleases me and hold fast to my covenant, to them I will give within my temple and its walls a memorial and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that will not be cut off. And foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to serve him, those I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Hello. There's something going on here, and it's not new. It's just its fulfillment.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's its fulfillment. So for those of you who think like that Old Testament God was really like such a terrible, bad, wrathful God, think again.
This was always the plan.
This was always the plan. I mean, to the eunuchs, I mean, we just mentioned, you know, like it's Pride Month.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And so, eunuchs really are mentioned in here as people who cannot procreate, which in that culture would have been like the definition of a man.
Yep. Yeah.
So those people who don't meet the definition.
Those who've been excluded for these. Yeah.
Yeah. Not and anymore. For some sort of considered sexual, you know, miss, not enough, whatever, deformity, all the things.
Yeah.
Actually, I am going to receive your sacrifice. I am going to forgive you. I am going to bind yourself. The promises are yours.
Yeah.
And to those foreigners who don't belong. This is all about the excluded. And Jeremiah 7 is around false religion that is worthless. And this is where Jeremiah is supposed to stand at the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim.
So he's supposed
message.
To be proclaiming at the temple. It's almost like Jesus is doing something here.
Right? This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, which is, by the way, why he doesn't want you, it's not because he's jealous of like those other gods, it's because it's going to harm you. Those gods are going to make you sacrifice your own children. Then I will let you live in this place in the land I gave your forefathers forever and ever. But look, you're trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house which bears my name and say, we are safe, safe to do all these detestable things? Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord. What? Ooh, okay, so you thought we were disruptive.
Yeah.
It looks Let exactly, us please introduce like, you to Jesus.
Like, folks, I'm really quite boring when you weigh me up against these other folks. I think the thing that comes through over and over again to me there is that Jesus first, you know, condemns those abusers, but in condemning the abusers, those who have been abused feel safe with him. And he, you know, thwarts those exploiters, but the exploited feel safe with him. And the, you know, he chastises those that don't want to welcome, but then those who have been unwelcome feel safe with him. Though there is something about that, that like when you call power out, when you call that sin out, those who have been oppressed by those systems and by that sin, you become a safe space for them. And again, that's, I know that's one of the great privileges, I think, of what we get to do as Christians is call those things out and say, "Yo, we'll try to do better. We'll try to be a safe space for you in a way that you've been let down before."
Yeah, and then there's this just this explosive thing that happens, like all the things you would hope that would happen in the temple of God, which is healing and signs and wonders and children and praise and shouting and dancing and like all the things that I hope would happen in the center place of God when you do get rid of the corruption, when you do expose the darkness and tell it to leave, when you do cleanse the temple, then what the temple was always for can actually happen. And this is, I think, for me, the great hope of this moment is that God doesn't expose things for fun. He doesn't just expose things for like, let's watch them squirm.
Yeah.
Like, let's see if these guys can take like his.
It's not shame for shame's sake.
It's for freedom.
Yeah.
Like literally to the people of God, like get free from these things so that you can experience the healing and the wholeness and the freedom that I have planned. So that this thing that you were called to for your whole life could be the city on a hill, could be a place of fulfillment and healing. And this is what we're all trying to be more like. So for me, proximity, like where you are, matters. Yeah. And actually, this is an interesting thing, even in light of my local context in my local church, is that I probably have more in common and associate more with the outside of the church than the inside of the church, because I didn't come from within.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, even all the way in terms of the inner sanctum or the inner leadership or the inner. So I kind of was an outsider in many ways, outside the theological realm, in a way, outside of the denomination, outside of the context. So in some ways, the outsiders, I can maybe feel a little bit more what that might feel like to feel outside. And then I think as soon as then you're silenced and you're mistreated and you're misaligned and your character is questioned, then you also can really, that's good for proximity, right? Because you're like, oh yeah, I know how that feels.
I think so my mother goes to church and my father doesn't. And so growing up, it was always kind of my choice, I suppose. But I don't know, I'm still here sticking around, I guess, all this time later. And some of the people ask my mother, you know, how did you get James to stick around? And her response, well, I never forced him to do anything. But I think in part of that is that there's such a kind of scarcity culture and fear that, like, well, the kids are going to fall away and then we'll never get them back. But for me, because I was never really in, I was just drawn to the beauty rather than, so I wasn't worried about the, you know, the fences. We're putting up fences to kind of keep people in. It's like, no, draw me in. Right. I say this all the time that,
tell me the story.
Yeah, exactly. I don't need to tell you about how awful life is without Jesus. You already know that. Let me show you how beautiful life is with Jesus. Wow. Let me show you him.
That's beautiful. That's really nice.
All right.
I like that a lot. And let's talk about the possibilities. Yeah. Well, there's so much. I feel like once you read those prophets, you're done. I don't really know what else to say apart from Isaiah and Jeremiah. I mean,
Isaiah and Jeremiah had quite a lot to say, actually. Yeah.
Actually, and Jesus' favorite prophets, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the fact that this is being said from the temple, in the temple, matters. Again, proximity.
And look who floods to him afterwards.
Yeah, and maybe that genuinely is, maybe people listen sort of going, well, how do I know if I'm corrupt? Like, how do I know if I'm exploitative? Like, how do I know? Well, maybe pay attention to who comes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If people who have been marginalized or exploited now feel safe in you, then you're probably doing something right.
It's not a bad measure.
We don't know how to deal with sincerity on this podcast. This is just very uncomfortable in here now.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. We got one more episode coming up at the shortest and the best flipping season yet.
Best flipping podcast
season yet. Yes. And we'll see in a bit. But we've got one more gospel to go. And I'm excited because, wow, everything flips over. Let's get to the other side together.